The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
The economy grows at 6.4% in the first quarter, and the Biden administration is proposing $6 trillion of new spending. Well, it's no surprise, stocks are at record levels. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour, a special program this week, as I will be doing an extensive interview with Jim Bianco as we cover the markets, taxes, Washington, cryptocurrencies, and even precious metals, all of that. Then joining me at the top of the hour will be Bullseye Craig Johnson. Craig is probably one of the most bullish guys on Wall Street. His forecast for the S&P was 4225. Well, as of this moment in this week, we're only 30 points away from Craig's target. And he sees some special industries to get invested in. One of them might really surprise you, especially given the Green New Deal. And then, of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up. Ryan?
It was one of the biggest reporting weeks of earnings this season, and yet the S&P 500 finished flat for the week. That should speak volumes on investor sentiment towards growth potential and current valuations. I'm going to throw some numbers out there to our listeners, so kind of prove my thesis on that, but I'll try not to bombard you going through the earnings season report card here. So before J.P. Morgan announced earnings on April 14th, the S&P 500 was up about 9.8% for the year. As we progress through the earnings season a few weeks now, I think 12 days, 60% of the S&P 500 has reported thus far. The stock market has added maybe a percent of gain, maybe a little bit less than that, since while earnings have been actually great. According to FactSet's data, of the companies that have reported thus far, about 86% have beat estimates, and that's well above the five-year average, right around 74%. On the revenue side of the story, 78% of companies reporting have beat estimates, also well above that five-year average, around 64%. Now, the growth rate for revenues, according to data and estimates, was right around 6.2% by the end of March. Going through earnings, as companies have been reporting, revenues have grown by 9.1%, and we're not done yet. That number keeps going up, it seems like, each week. So to say that profits and growth, we have already priced in what companies were announcing, well, is that fair, given that companies are surprising by a wide margin and well above that five-year average? It is fair, maybe, in the sense that it's never the news that's important, but the reaction to the news. So even if we assume investors priced in growth we're seeing or not, the reaction hasn't been much, with the stock market only up maybe a percent for the earnings season. So the growing consensus right now is that earnings news was priced in, and there is concern over whether companies can continue to beat estimates at this rate. And maybe it's just time for that E to catch up to the P in PE multiples. The Federal Open Market Committee met and announced leaving rates at zero, leaving the pace for asset purchases unchanged at $120 billion per month. It was unclear heading into the announcement if the Fed might hint plans to taper, maybe in the near future, but Federal Chair Powell said it wasn't time to start talking about tapering and reiterated it will take substantial progress toward employment and inflationary goals. Yields declined on the news somewhat, with the 10-year yield unchanged on the day Wednesday at 1.62%, but clearly the accommodative stance is here. Prolonged asset purchase plans are also here, and that did little to move the stock market. The S&P finished down 0.1% after that news on Wednesday. Now, Biden rolled out the American Families Plan this week to pay for the investment. Wealthy Americans earning more than $1 million a year could see capital gain taxes increase from 20% to 39.6%, and the top rate would rise from 37% to 39.6% if the plan gets through. On the benefits side of the plan, there's a lot going on, so I'll try to highlight as best I can here. There would be a 12-week paid parental, family, and personal illness safe leave. They would extend tax credits and further provide extensions on expanded child tax credits that could cause families in the lowest 20% wage percentile to receive an additional $4,250 of income boost, according to a study by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Now, the plan is looking at providing free community college. That's 2 years. There's another part of the bill aimed at investing $45 billion into nutrition support for children, education, and other programs. The plan is also looking at child care reform by investing $225 billion into minimum wages and training for providers and a cap to no more than 7% of income for low to middle income earners, where child care is a very big burden. And assisting them with that, that could potentially provide around $14,800 in savings per year. Finally, there will be unemployment insurance reform that will adjust the length and amount of benefits depending on economic conditions. So a lot there to part two of Biden's plans. Now, the economic reports this week were strong, but that didn't also seem to change the narrative. Not a whole lot has changed the narrative at all this week, even though there's a lot going on. The advanced estimates for GDP in the first quarter showed annualized growth of around 6.4%, with increases in government spending of 6.3%, and personal consumption expenditures were up around 10.7%, showing just a real sharp bounce in economic activity from the lockdown due to COVID and other weather issues early in the quarter. Consumer confidence jumped to 121.7 in April from 109 in March, showing just clear improvement in attitudes towards conditions for consumers. Obviously, some checks have been received. On that note, personal income surged 21.1% in March versus February, with the PCE price index up 0.5%, putting it at about a 2.3% pace year over year. And finally, the Case-Shiller Home Price Index increased 11.9% in February, following 12.1% increase in January. So big movement in prices there for homes. Again, we talked about that, I think, last week, where affordability is starting to hurt sales. We still have another 40% of the S&P 500 left to report, but so far the report card has been stellar. The Fed continues to provide full accommodation with no communication yet otherwise. And we finally heard about that second part of Biden's big fiscal investment plans, with both plans provided by taxation over time funding versus straight debt, which seems to be appeasing the bond vigilantes, where rates have been fairly steady this past month. That's it for this week's wrap-up report. Jim, back to you.
California Governor Gavin Newsom has declared a water emergency and rationing in a number of counties throughout California. And as well as, if you look at the U.S. Drought Monitor, large parts of the western U.S. are now listed as either being in severe or exceptional drought. In light of this, we invited James Garris of the Browning World Climate Bulletin back on the show to give his outlook on the worsening drought situation, particularly in the western half of the U.S., whether we could see large dust bowls similar to what we saw take place during the Great Depression, and his near-term outlook on agriculture commodities. Here's a clip of what he told listeners this week on FS Insider.
Long-term, over the 2020s, we are looking at a strong probability of drought continuing to be a problem for states west of the Rockies. The reason that I don't see the same difficulties occurring, what we remember of the Dust Bowl back in the early and mid-1900s, primarily has to do with technology and technological advances. We didn't have reservoirs. We didn't have water-saving technologies. We didn't have a lot of the various technological advances then that we have today.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939. Or email grow at financialsense.com.
Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
While the stock market seems to love all the macro environment, you've got 0% interest rates, the Fed is not in a hurry to raise them, as we learned this week, and the administration is proposing $6 trillion of new spending. Well, it's no surprise, stocks are at record levels. Well, let's find out where we go from here. Joining us on the program is Bullseye Craig Johnson. Craig, let's talk about the stock market, and you probably are one of the most bullish people that we saw at the beginning of the year. Let's talk about your targets for year end and where are we?
Thanks, Jim, and thanks for having me back on. Yes, we set out what we thought was a pretty aggressive price objective of, you know, 42.25 on the S&P for year end. I didn't say first half of 2021, but year end 2021. And as of right now, Jim, we're about less than 30 points away from achieving that year-end objective ahead of time.
Let's stay on that topic. If we were to hit your target here, and like you said, we're only about 30 points away on the S&P from hitting your target. If we hit that target, what do you expect to happen afterwards? Do we go higher or do we go through a corrective phase?
Well, Jim, I have gone through over the last couple of weeks and I've updated the model that I use, same model I've used for the last 10 years or more for the market. And I do see some modest upside from that 42.25 number. Again, earnings estimates are coming up. Stocks seem to be responding to that improvement in the earnings. So, you know, maybe you see another 10 or 12% upside, something in that kind of vicinity. But, you know, I don't like to count the chickens before they're hatched, Jim. So until that number gets touched and exceeded, I will stick with my 42.25 for now. But yes, I do see some modest upside.
Well, Craig, let's talk about some of the numbers. We just saw first quarter GDP is over 6%, and corporate earnings have been stellar. I mean, just take a look at Apple's blowout earnings. But let me ask you this. When Trump passed his tax bill cut and dropped the tax rates from 35 to 21, we saw a huge increase in corporate profits in 2018. What would happen, do you think, to the market if we raise tax rates on corporations from 21 to 28? That's got to have an impact on what's going to come out in corporate earnings.
Yeah, you know, Jim, we've done some of this work going all the way back in time. And what we found is if these corporate tax rates are going to be going up from 21 to, say, 28%, and you know, who knows, maybe that number is going to prove to be a little bit high, or perhaps it's going to be a negotiation point for some of these things. But when we've gone back and we've looked at these pieces with the corporate tax rate going up, it's had a little bit of a negative, impact on a relative basis to kind of historical performance. But I got to tell you that when we've gone through and looked at the three forms of tax increase coming through, whether it's capital gains tax, personal taxes, or the corporate tax rate, the two that are probably the most in order of pain would be first if personal taxes go up. The second one would be if corporate taxes go up. And the third would be the capital gains tax rate going up. So it will be definitely creating somewhat of a headwind potentially for the market. There's no doubt about it. I know some people have said that as you see this corporate tax rate go up from 21 to the 28, it might be just a 2 or 3% impact. I think you got to look back at other periods. It could be slightly more than that. That could be challenging for earnings. And Jim, I look at earnings numbers coming in right now because you also just touched on that. And I look at the numbers right now and you're looking for about $180 in earnings now for 2021. And we're up about 6.5% over the last 90 days. But I think it's important to point out to all the listeners, I don't think the advance in this market from here is going to be coming from multiple expansion. Okay. I think it's got to come purely from earnings because we're already trading at basically 23.5 times 2021 earnings. And if we're going to be looking for another 10 or 12% upside, like we discussed a few moments ago, we've got to basically put about a 26, 27 multiple on forward earnings to get to those kind of numbers, Jim, which historically speaking is rich, but certainly can occur.
So if we look at this environment, let's assume that we remain in a low interest rate environment with the Fed, maybe managing the yield curve. And then also we have the $6 trillion that could be injected into the economy in the form of stimulus. Let's talk about the sectors. How do you play this? I mean, if we take a look at last year, it was kind of like the COVID stocks, your Zoom, your Pelotons, then, of course, the FANG stocks. What do you see occurring in the market right now in terms of sectors? Is it broad-based? Are there certain sectors that stand out to you?
Yeah, so I think the way that we should be thinking about this market, the way that we should be playing it, I think would be number one, we got to play this from a financial perspective, as I think the financial sector is certainly going to benefit from the rising rates. Stocks like Charles Schwab should benefit from having a higher return on some of the money market funds. I think also the banks should do well as they watch the 2-10 spread sort of widen out. So definitely got to be there with the financials, first and foremost. The second way to play this out, if rates are going to keep moving up and inflationary pressures are going to build, I think we got to think about the basic materials companies. And I think you even have to think about energy and sort of a reopening trade side of the things. But the problem with that, Jim, and we've highlighted this in our Informed Investor publication that I know you get, come out. But if you look at the combination of basic materials, energy, industrials, utilities, transportation, like these five sectors, they don't even add up to the entire weight of the technology sector. So a lot of the portfolio managers end up with a challenge. Do I really buy basic materials or energy stocks when there are 2-3% of the entire marketplace right now? Most of them end up not having exposure there. And this is where the pain has really come in this year. And challenge for a lot of managers is that none of them are going to get overweight energy or basic materials. And some, from ESG screening purposes, won't buy energy stocks at all. And you look at what is the best performing sector year to date, it's energy, up 20% and change. They won't buy them. So that's where some of the challenge and pain has come in.
So if you look at this, and let's talk about energy, the Biden administration is plugging the Green New Deal. A lot of that is going to be centered around EVs, EV charging stations. Let's talk about something that all EVs require, which is nickel and copper.
I look at things like Freeport-McMoRan. I look at Southern Copper. I look at these companies. The charts look terrific. I would also put into this, if we're going to go electric vehicle, a lot of these cars are now getting made out of aluminum bodies and chassis to keep weight down too. And stocks like Alcoa are doing very well too. But Jim, I'll take it a little bit of a different direction with your question too, is I recently had the fun opportunity to drive an electric vehicle. I had the opportunity when I took my car in to get serviced here at a local place in Minneapolis. It was the Audi dealership. And they said, hey, do you want to try the new EV, their e-tron car? And I said, absolutely. Well, drove it for a few days. Great. Enjoyed it tremendously. Great car. But when I came to charge it, if I plug it into a 120 outlet, Jim, it took 11 hours to charge this car. And it made it one thing very, very clear to me. And I thank them for letting me borrow it because I really enjoyed it. But it made me realize we don't have enough electricity coming into every home in this country to move to electric vehicles if you're going to be doing charging at home. And it's fine. You can maybe say I'll charge it all night long and get enough charge that way at 120 volt. But if you're doing road trips or going cross country, you need the superchargers. Those superchargers will recharge the car in 20 minutes, but it's also like 480 watts. I mean, multiples higher than what we have in most people's homes for typical outlets, Jim. So what I keep thinking about is electric utilities. I mean, I wonder if the growth in EVs mean that, and again, you can laugh at me when I say this, but maybe the electric utility companies are going to become growth stocks once again as we start watching more and more people transition to electric vehicles. The infrastructure, the power demand, they're all going to be going up at very quick paces.
You know, I was looking at the very same thing, in fact, but here's a question I raise. You know, you take my own state of California, which has ruled after 2030, Craig, you won't be able to buy gas-powered cars. Everything's going to be EVs. But California shut down both of its nuclear power plants. They don't want nat gas plants. And I just don't know, Craig, if wind and solar is going to do it. Like you said, if we all go to EVs, that means instead of at night with less pressure put on the grid, that's going to change. We're all going to have our electric cars in the garage. Everybody's going to be charging their cars on the grid at night. Where's this power going to come from?
100% agree with you on that question. They're going to have to, it can't all be done through solar. It can't all be done through wind power. I think that's the number one challenge that's going to have to be addressed. Not only where are they going to generate that from, Jim, and also what do they have enough transmission capacity to handle this rapid pickup and growth in the electrical demand too? I mean, again, your state pointing out the obvious, but you get rolling blackouts that are occurring when you have very warm temperature days already. Hence, that has been a huge driver for Generac. And that seems like that's the trend that's going to continue to keep playing out. But Jim, at the end of the day, I would say that even though there is some sort of disdain for the nuclear aspect here, I think this is going to have to be some other forms of that that are going to have to come into play to get the electrical power consumption that the country is going to need, because clearly it's not going to happen through coal, and it's clearly not going to happen through wind and solar.
Yeah, I'm very bullish on nuclear right now. Craig, let's talk about something else here, and that's inflation. The Fed is saying that any inflation that arises is going to be temporary. Typically, if you start getting inflationary readings as we've been getting lately, like the PPI and the CPI, you normally see things like precious metals do well. Gold seems like it's struggling here. What's your take on the precious metals, number one? And number two, what impact is cryptocurrencies having on the gold market?
Excellent question. I'm going to rewind just to your initial statement there in question, which is this inflationary? Is it temporary? Is it transitory, as the Fed has called it? In my view, when I look at lumber prices, aluminum prices, I look at what's happening with crude oil prices, all those, as I put it together, I would say these are commodity-based. I've always sort of viewed those as transitory, okay? Until we start seeing wage inflation starting to come up, that is when I think you will truly start to have sticky kind of inflation that's not going to be transitory, in my humble opinion. Coming back to your other question, Jim, about gold, silver, and those things. Well, we just had marked these up in our publication. And as I look at gold, gold has got a pretty important sort of support level to be watching right around 1800. We're trading just below that the way it is now. If we start seeing more of those inflationary pressures, I think you're going to see gold actually start to work and work well. But right now, between gold, that 1800 level is a really important support level I'll be watching. And then in silver, it looks like we're making more of sort of a sideways consolidation, which I would define as a symmetrical triangle, which is typically a continuation pattern, Jim. So I am not overweight any of those areas at this point in time with our model and those work that we're doing, but I will definitely be watching those very carefully. Now, what does this mean for cryptocurrency? I think you got to take it a little bit of a different direction. I think we got to look at how much money is really being spent at this point in time, whether it's $6 trillion, $8 trillion. The number seems to be kind of limitless at this point in time. And what I'll be watching very carefully is 10-year bond yields and the dollar. And if I start watching the dollar falling, 10-year bond yields coming up, then all this spending that's happening will have probably gone too far, and you're starting to do harm to the dollar, which again, king dollar. Nobody's questioned king dollar yet. But if I start seeing that trend happening, that is going to be a very negative trend that the country is going to have to go deal with. What does that mean for cryptocurrencies? Keep spending in Washington and these cryptocurrencies are going to look a lot better. And I know they can come out and say, hey, we're going to regulate them. We're going to put an 80% tax on them. We're going to do all these other different types of things. I guess that is the solution of what they could ultimately do. But the reality is we keep talking about the New Deal and we talk about trying to be forward leading in the world at this point in time. Well, these cryptocurrencies and these electronic forms of exchange, that is the leading area, but yet they want to tax them and they want to continue to put some other roadblocks and barriers up. China doesn't seem to be doing that. I don't know why we should either.
So, Craig, given where we are right now, as we started this conversation, we're about 30 points away from your year-end target of 42.25 on the S&P. What would you be doing here as an investor?
What I'd be thinking about, again, think about age, how long you have until retirement. First thing is I'd be taking a long sort of approach toward this market because money keeps coming in. The Fed isn't cutting rates or taking back any of the stimulus or buying packages at this point in time. So I think you want to stay long. But I would also be thinking about how do you generate income? Okay, because we're all going to need income. And if that capital gains rate is going to be going up as much as they're discussing, I think a lot of investors are going to be getting very focused on creating income. And I can think of a nice smart portfolio of about 9 utility stocks that could create a nice paycheck of the month for people and get paid three dividends every month out of these 9 companies. But I think those dividends and income, Jim, are where a lot of investors are going to have to get focused.
Couldn't agree more. Well, listen, Craig, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the great work you guys do, how could they do so?
Feel free to send me an email. You can reach me at craig.johnson@psc.com.
All right. Well, listen, stay safe, my friend, and let's have a steak next time you come in town.
Yes, sir.
There's a lot of attention being paid to the fact that margin debt is now at a new all-time record high. We saw that in the tech bubble peak of 2000, also in the 2007 peak, a big spike in margin debt, which we see now. What would you say about some of these growing concerns?
Well, I think it's really important to track margin debt, but I think the way that it's been tracked by a lot of people is not that helpful. And if you look back at 1999 and 2007, you see this really noticeable buildup in margin debt relative to the market. And that's the key, is that if you see a buildup in margin debt above and beyond the pace of increase in the market, that's when I would get concerned. So I have this chart that sort of shows a warning level, and we've started to rise on that, but we're still quite a ways away from that warning level.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, Wall Street is getting more bullish. The economy is expected to grow at one of the fastest rates we've seen in decades, and they're predicting better corporate earnings and higher stock prices. How far will this go? Let's find out. Joining me on the program is James Bianco of Bianco Research. Jim, let's begin with the economy. You know, if we take a look at in December, Trump passed a $900 billion stimulus. Biden passed a $1.9 trillion stimulus. Now they're talking about, I don't know, pick a number, $2 trillion to $4 trillion in infrastructure spending. Let's talk about the impact on the economy. Where do you see it going?
Well, the first impact on the economy is the December bill had a $600 stimulus check. The March bill, which we just got done with, had a $1,400 stimulus check. So over 100 million Americans got $2,000. In addition to, there's some extra money for unemployment insurance and a bunch of extra other packages, which are direct transfers of money to people. If you look at the savings rate in the country, it's the highest it's ever been. It's 20% right now. So a lot of this money has been going into savings, which is a fancy way of saying the stock market, which is a fancy way of saying everybody's Robinhood account if you're a millennial. And it's been piling up there, and they've been waiting for a sign that things are getting better and get the confidence to start spending that money. And I think we're very, very close to that happening in the next month or two, unless there's some kind of a U-turn in the case count with the coronavirus, which has been falling and falling. And unleashing all of that money onto the economy is the hope, if you listen to the Federal Reserve Chairman, is, oh, that will produce tremendous growth. It will produce falling unemployment. And that's actually true, but it can also produce inflation. And that can be very problematic for financial markets if it also produces inflation as well, too.
You know, let's talk about that for a minute, because the Fed is saying, you know, as the economy bounces back from the pandemic, that the inflation numbers are only temporary. You know, I'm looking, Jim, lumber prices are up close to 300%, copper's up close to 90%, corn 70%, CRB index. Everywhere you look, real estate prices on residential homes up 15%. How temporary is that? That sounds, as these cost of materials, you're seeing like Procter & Gamble announcing that they're raising prices across the board in September. Wall Street Journal article recently on China manufacturers raising prices due to transportation and input costs. So how temporary is this? And could the Fed be making a mistake on their assumption of being temporary?
Well, first of all, the word they like to use is transitory. You know, you got to be into the real Fed speak to use transitory as your word. And they repeat it over and over again. They're acknowledging that over the short term, and they're saying that the short term is, say, the rest of this year into the early part of 22, you will see higher inflation. But then they expect that that will back off. The assumption that drives all of their thinking is they use another Fed term, which is well anchored, that they think inflation is well anchored. And a good example of that is something you just mentioned, Procter & Gamble. Procter & Gamble announced on their earnings call last week that they're going to raise the prices on many of their products in September. And then they announced that they're going to give us a series of press releases and explanations between now and September. Hey, P&G, it's not that hard to raise prices. Just raise them. You don't need to agonize over this with a series of multiple press releases in order to explain and justify why you're raising prices. But that's the way corporations and managers have been taught over the last 25 years. Because in the past, if you raised prices, you were on the second page of a Google search from lowest price to highest price, and you lost all your market share. Oh, your price is too high. There's other options that are lower, and everybody went to those other options. If, on the other hand, they raise prices and they don't lose market share, and everybody else follows and they don't lose market share, then in Fed speak, it becomes unanchored. In terms of then it's no longer, I got to put out a press release and need 4 months to explain why I'm raising prices. I'll just announce effective tomorrow morning, here's the new price, and either pay it or don't. And so if we get to that point, the Fed says, we have tools to deal with that. And that's code word for they could stop their bond purchases or raise interest rates. But if you get if you get unanchored, it is very painful what you'd have to do to get prices well anchored again. I'm trying to use Fed speak here. I've joked around that I've said, yeah, it's like me saying that I've got a tool for gangrene. It's called a bone saw. Well, I don't want to get to that point that you're going to have to drag out the bone saw to try and stop inflation. And that's the risk that the Fed faces, is that they are going to be very accepting of higher inflation rates. Why? Because they're focused on unemployment and they want to see people in the lower reaches of the economy get a job. Very laudable goal. But if that comes about because you give us too much inflation and you unanchor the expectations on inflation, it no longer is it the months of press releases, it's just raised prices. To bring that back into line, to get financial markets to think you're going to bring it back into line, it could be very stressful on financial markets. And let's hope we don't get there. But that's the risk that the Fed is willing to take, is that they're going to let it run. They're going to bet that inflation will naturally recede next year. We'll see.
Jim, what about, let's talk about this risk of inflation. The Fed would like to see the unemployment rate lowered, but aren't some of these government policies, like, for example, raising the minimum wage or giving unemployment benefits that are better than what some people can get in restaurants? I mean, I don't know what it's like where you're at. Here, we see help wanted signs, and a lot of these restaurants can't compete with unemployment.
Yeah. You know, I was taught in college that when you raise the price of something, you get less of it. So if you raise the price of labor, you're going to get less of labor. Or you raise the price of not working, you're going to get less workers, to say it correctly, as well, too. And that is a real problem. And what's happening, this gets back to my previous comment. When you're met with a squeeze and those restaurants that you see that are begging for employees, you've got one of two options. You can either raise your prices to meet that increased demand, or you can ration your product. And a lot of companies are choosing to ration their product. Some examples are well known. Go to Menards or Home Depot and buy a refrigerator or buy a dishwasher. And, you know, it'll have sale, you know, lowest price all over it. And then they'll say, great, you bought it. You'll get it in September. They don't have them. They're rationing them out is what they're doing. They don't want to raise their price. Well, that's happening with labor, too. Here in, I'm in Chicago. There are restaurants here in Chicago that are not only asking for help wanted signs, but they're not open every day of the week because they only open on the days that they can get enough people in the restaurant to properly function. They're rationing their labor is what they're doing. The fix is pay them more. They're afraid to pay them more because they're afraid to raise their prices. And this gets back to my previous comment. Everybody's afraid to do that. But once it starts and I raise my prices and I pay my employees more and I raise the prices of my restaurant to offset it. And guess what? The same number of people show up at my restaurant than before. We have now unanchored inflation. So you're starting to see that as well, too, in the economy. So what is happening is this is encouraging inflation. So I understand we're going to give people unemployment benefits to not work. We're going to give them incentives. We're going to demand that companies raise the minimum wage. And remember, it's not just the minimum wage. That's the base salary. So if you raise the base salary to $15, then the person who's worked for 6 months gets $17, and it feeds all the way up the line, which is why labor unions are so in favor of minimum wage hikes, even though very few minimum wage employees are unionized, because they know that it feeds all the way up the line for their workers as well, too. But if you get to that point where you start raising those prices and you find that you are not like on the second page of that Google search, that no, people continue to show up and they just pay higher prices, then we're in a whole new regime and we're in a regime of unanchored inflation. And we'll see where do we go? But you're right. Right now, the policies are almost not only encouraging, but almost demanding that we see higher inflation.
And what would be the key pivot points that you would look for to basically say we're becoming unanchored?
I would look at some of the numbers. Procter & Gamble, you know, their fourth quarter earnings number would be a good one. They're going to raise their prices in September. Okay. Let's see what they report for their fourth quarter. How much did it impact them to raise their prices? Was it positive? They sold the same number of units at a higher price? Or was it negative because there's some elasticity in their price that when they raised it, they sold less of the products that they decided to raise? And on down the line, I would see a lot of that. In this current earnings report, Q1 earnings are being released. We're a little more than halfway through the first quarter. There's been a 300% increase in companies talking about inflation over previous quarters. And the number of companies talking about inflation now is the highest ever. The data goes back to 2004. We don't know what they were like in the late 70s. We don't have data on that. So they're all talking about inflation, which is code for where they're all talking about raising their prices. So let's see what happens in the third and fourth quarter earnings for those companies that raise prices. Did they get punished like they would in the past? Everybody just stopped buying their product because there's cheaper alternatives. Or did everybody else raise their price and everybody just paid up and we just continued on with the same unit sales, but a higher price? If you see that, then you know that we are in an inflationary regime.
I want to come back to a comment that you made that savings are at the highest rate. They're at close to 20%. So, you know, a lot of consumers are kind of sitting back. Is the economy going to open up? Will I have my job? And they feel secure. So what happens when this money, you know, as you know, inflation sometimes is a lot psychological as well. So if consumers start seeing prices rise at the store, prices rise on, you know, everything from cars to homes and everything else, that psychological effect starts to change and people start saying, I better buy it now because it's going to be more expensive tomorrow.
That's exactly right. Throw in the idea that they've been locked in their home for a year or many for most a year. They're itching to get back to some sense of normalcy. And I'll say sense of normalcy because we're going to have to figure out what normal means. So we're going to start to pay up for certain things as well, too. So to use my another Chicago example, whenever Wrigley Field opens up in a big way, and I want to, you know, do something that is a ritual in summers in Chicago, and that is to go to Wrigley Field and enjoy a ball game, I'm not going to care that much about the price. I just want to do it because I wasn't able to do it last year, and I want to go sit in the sun and enjoy a nice afternoon. And all down the line, I want a new car. I didn't have a new car. I've been stuck at home. I want to move. I want some new clothes. I want to travel. Whatever it happens to be that is of their interest, I've got some money. The government mailed it to me. So I'll pay up a little bit and finally get to do it. I'm tired of just sitting at home, locked in my house for the last year. In other words, what I'm trying to say is the ingredients are in place for people to just pay up for a lot of this stuff. You're right. And when the psychology is there of paying up, that's when it's really hard to reverse. And that's what the Fed and the federal government, because it's not all the Fed. A lot of these policies are the federal government's policies, though the Fed may tacitly approve of them. It is still the government, the federal government's policies. They could be leading towards that inflation. And again, this could be very unsettling for the stock and bond markets, if that we ever got to that point.
So as we look at this and we have the ingredients there, everything in place for inflation to accelerate, let's talk about the bond market and the bond market's reaction to that. How does the Fed control that? Do they do yield curve management?
Yeah, you know, so the Fed has talked about that quite a bit. First of all, as a backdrop, August of last year, 10 months ago, the 10-year yield was at 50 basis points, 0.5%. As we're recording right now, it's at 1.6%. So it's over one full percentage point higher in 10 months. It's been as high as 1.77% back in late March as well, too. So there's been a very strong uptrend in yields. I think a lot of that has been driven by a lot of what we're seeing right now, all the savings, the booming commodity prices, and the expectations that we might see some inflation. Should interest rates continue to move higher, the Fed is going to be stuck with a dilemma. Let me back up now. Interest rates going up are neither bullish or bearish for an economy or the stock market. Why are they going up? If they're going up because we've got strong growth and we're putting people back to work and we're increasing everybody's net worth, and this and is important, no inflation, stock market's fine with it, the economy will be fine with rising rates. It's just raising the cost of capital through higher standards of living. But if interest rates are rising, and part of that is higher inflation, so my dollar in a year buys less than now, that is a problem. If rates are rising because of reflation or real growth, then Fed policies like yield curve control or buying more 10-year notes, extending the maturities, as they call it, those can work to suppress interest rates and have that. Extending maturities is a form of QE and have for the last 10 years or so. But if rates are rising because inflation is the fear and the Fed tries to suppress interest rates because of inflation, that could be met with a very toxic reaction, I think, in the bond market. And so it really comes down to why do we think rates are going up? Now, of course, if they do start to head higher and make a new high for the year, which I think they will by summer, 180 or higher, the immediate reaction by the Federal Reserve and Jay Powell will be, oh, this is a good thing. This shows you that the economy is getting better. He'll be giving you the real growth angle on it. Well, just because he says it doesn't make it so. It'll be whether or not the bond market agrees with it. The bond market agrees with it, that 180 yield will moderate at those levels. If the bond market doesn't agree with it, we could go right to 2% right after he says something like that. And then we could really start to spook the stock market, something like we saw in March, but it might actually be a little bit bigger. So it depends on why we go higher, and we'll have to see, you know, how this unfolds in the second half of the year.
So if we take a look at, since this pandemic, the government has been spending trillions of dollars of stimulus to keep the economy afloat. And we've seen it with Biden's stimulus bill at the beginning of the year. They're talking about infrastructure, $2 to $4 trillion. So they want to see unemployment drop, the economy improve. But let's talk about a countervailing force, which would be higher taxes. They talked last week about raising the capital gains rate for upper income Americans to 44%. You know, I think about that, Jim, in my own state of California, where the income tax rate is 13, or New York. You're talking about the government taking 56 to 57% of a capital gain. I mean, what impact will that have, in your opinion, on the markets or even longer term on the economy?
Well, look, first of all, let's put these numbers into perspective here. The deficit right now is $4.5 trillion with the T. That's the rolling year-over-year deficit. It is 19% of GDP. There's only been 2 years in American history when the deficit was larger than that, and that's 1944 and 1945 as a percent of GDP, when we were basically printing money to make tanks and airplanes to win World War II. And then in 1946, the deficit halved itself and then halved itself again in 1947. So it was a temporary thing, but nobody thinks this one's temporary at this point. So big is the deficit that taxes make up about 45% of government spending. So the government has to borrow 55 cents and they tax about 45 cents. The last time it's been below 50% was World War II. The last time before that was World War I. And so it has been a long time since we've seen that. So in one respect, I could almost say it doesn't matter at this point. If you're, unless you're going to double taxes for everybody, I just don't mean for the rich, I mean double taxes for everybody. If you're going to take the amount of spending that the government does and cover 45% of it with taxes now and take that to 50 or 55, so what? You might as well just borrow that extra 10%. Now, if you want to take it to 70 or 80% of taxes covers your spending on a $4.5 trillion deficit, then, you know, the marginal tax rates will have to start at 40% and go to 70 or 80 at that point. So at one level, I don't think it matters, but that's not the way they're selling it. They're selling it as an argument about fairness. Is what they're, or as I like to say, fairness is just a nice way to say punishment. They're just trying to punish people that have been successful under this guise of fairness. And so it really does start to pile up. In your state of California, if you're in the high end, what is it, 14% is your marginal income tax rate? If you're, you know, in the millionaire bracket and you don't get to deduct your state and local taxes anymore. So effectively, you're paying something like a 20-25% income tax rate. I know I'm depressing you, you know, in the state of California, I know that's a weather. There's a weather tax, but boy, that's a big weather tax to have to pay to live in Southern California. In New York, is just as bad, and they don't have the nice weather in New York. But so these taxes are really going to start to add up. If you tax people, you're going to see an immediate change of behavior. You know, and how that behavior changes is going to be very hard to discern. Because essentially what you're doing is you're saying that that 44% capital gains rate on the highest earners, that's their income level. You're almost encouraging them to be day traders. Because if I buy a stock and I sell it this afternoon, I pay a 44% tax. If I invest in a project or a company and hold it for 5 years, I pay 44% tax. So, you know, there is no encouragement to have long-term deals. There's no encouragement to look bigger picture, other than that you think it's going to gain a lot of money. Now, in the terms of technology, you might still do it because you think you're going to get a 20x return. But in the terms of regular capital improvement projects or industrial companies or consumer cyclical companies or some healthcare companies or some energy companies, hey, here's a great idea. We're going to have a payoff in 5 years. What's your payoff going to be? 8%, 10%? Well, so what? I can make that in a week if I pick the right technology company. So no thank you for your consumer cyclical investments or your healthcare investments. The old economy that is slower growth, a little bit more stable, loses in that environment. And all everybody's going to want to chase is high beta, racy stuff that if it works, I make a really lot of money and I don't care if I'm going to pay 44%. So it could very well change the investment landscape, I think, in ways that we just are not getting our head around right now.
So let's get back to the deficits. You mentioned earlier that this year it's going to be 19% of GDP. We haven't been there since 1944 and 45. You know, modern monetary theory seems to be embraced by both parties. Trump was running trillion-dollar deficits even before a recession. So at what point, in CBO is talking about 12 to 15% deficits almost this decade, at what point does the market rebel, or global bond markets rebel against this, and what impact will that have on the dollar?
I think it comes back to our earlier conversation, and that comes back to inflation. There is really not a relationship between supply of sovereign government debt and its interest rate. If you issue more, rates don't necessarily go up, and if you issue less, rates necessarily go down. It's more about the demand for it. But remember what deficit spending is. We're producing money out of thin air. So what we're doing is the government says, we'll just issue $10 billion worth of bonds. We'll just issue it. There we go. We just did. Now we got $10 billion. What are we going to do with the $10 billion? We're going to spend it in some way, either give it to people to spend, or the government spends it directly, and they're going to push prices higher. So where does the bond market rebel? When all this deficit spending produces inflation. And then they run away from it. But if all this deficit spending produces no inflation, then they won't run away from it. Or let me restate what I've said. I've often argued that 2021 is going to be the year of inflation. Either we get it or we don't. If we get it, and I've been making the case we will. But what if we don't get inflation? What if my friend David Rosenberg is right in that we have a temporary blip in inflation and then it goes back down? And I've argued with Rosie a number of times. I've said, then we're just going to send more checks out. We're going to have bigger deficit spending. Because if we can deficit spend without a consequence, and a consequence being inflation or any other consequence to the economy, then everybody wins. The poor get some money, the unemployed get a bridge to their next job, and wealthy, and let's define the wealthy as stockholders, they see new highs in equity markets, then mail more checks. Do more deficit spending. Why would you stop doing it? So we're going to continue down this path until we go too far. I can't imagine, especially a Democrat-controlled Congress, to say, we spent $4 trillion and everybody won and there was no consequence like inflation. I think we've done enough. Let's stop. No, they're not going to. Their only reason they're going to stop is because you've spent $4 trillion and markets went kablooey because you went too far. That's why you stop. So ultimately, I think we're gonna wind up continuing to do this, and it'll be expressed as modern monetary theory or universal basic income or whatever we want to do, but we're just not going to willy-nilly stop. And that's why I think we've may have gone to that point already, and we're going to see inflation soon. But if we don't, and you have me back in a year and you go, what happened to inflation? I'd say it didn't materialize, but I suspect I'd say, but look at where the deficit is now. And look at how many more checks we're planning on mailing out now, because there was no consequence to the previous round of them.
You know, one final question on taxes before we move on. In modern monetary theory, I mean, if you can just print the money and send out checks, I mean, why even go to the trouble of raising taxes when you can just print it?
Well, modern monetary theory says something like that. And to be fair about it, what they say is that you can print the money, you can borrow the money, and you can fix your roads and do whatever other projects that you deem important by just borrowing it. Yes, modern monetary theory says you can go too far and you can then create inflation. They do admit that there is that point. They also would argue it's much further than everybody thinks. And then the remedy for what do you do when you have inflation is you raise taxes, and that sucks money out of the economy and brings inflation down. And then when the inflation rate comes down, you can lower taxes. So in their world, in our world right now, tax rates very rarely change. And when they do, as we're talking now, it's a painful process of arguing about it for a year to change a tax rate. So they're essentially flat, and interest rates vacillate up and down with the business cycle. In their world, interest rates are stuck at zero or 1% or some very low rate, and they never move. And taxes vacillate up and down with the business cycle. I like the idea in theory, But in reality, I don't know what is this taxing authority that's going to announce, oh, you know, inflation went up, we're going to raise your taxes now for the next few months, and then we're going to lower them later this year. Kind of like a Fed, like an open market committee for taxes, where every 6 weeks we're going to hang on every word about whether they're going to change their tax rates. I just don't think we're ready for that type of level of volatility in tax rates. But that's what the modern monetary theory suggests. So I do want to be fair to them. They do admit that there is a level that you could spend too much and create inflation, and their remedy is taxes. But to your original question, you're right. They've often argued that if you are deficit spending with no inflation, yes, your tax rate should be down around zero, and we'll raise it when we need to later.
I want to move on to another topic that you've been recently speaking about. Let's talk about cryptocurrencies. You know, it was just announced today an NFL football player is going to take his salary in Bitcoin. So, I mean, is this a sign of the future?
Yeah, at least he's not taking it in Dogecoin. So yes. I mean, cryptocurrencies is a complicated subject. On the one side of the subject is that people are wildly speculating on them for the hopes of massive returns very quickly. That seems to be a bit overheated, and that seems to be ripe with issues and problems. Dogecoin, as I mentioned, SafeMoon, another one of these coins that appeared out of nowhere and 10x'd in a week and got everybody excited. But if you step back and you look on the other side and you look at Ethereum, which is the second largest cryptocurrency after Bitcoin, and it's smart contracts. Its smart contracts is it's programmable, and that they're creating a whole new financial system with these programmable contracts under the name of decentralized finance or DeFi. There are projects or protocols, as they call them, for borrowing and for lending and for automatic trading. Automatic trading meaning completely algorithmic trading, no human involved with it. Insurance, lotteries, all up and down the line. They are creating a wholly new parallel financial system right now. And to show that this system is working, they're doing something we've never seen in American history. They're financing themselves. They're creating these coins or tokens, and they're using the increased value of these coins or tokens to finance their projects as well, too. So to give you an example of what's happening in this decentralized world, if you wander over into this decentralized world, and the way you have to do it is you start off by opening an account like on a Gemini or Kraken or a Coinbase, and you buy some Ethereum, transferring money from your bank account. Then you have to transfer your money from there to what's called an unregulated wallet. And once you're there, you connect to the website of a Uniswap, which is the largest automatic market maker. It trades about 3/4 of the size of Coinbase, which at one point was valued at $100 billion. It was only created 2 years ago. It has less than 20 employees. And when you start to see what they're doing in these spaces, they've really recreated the financial system. Every trade that's done on the Uniswap platform, a little bit of the commission goes into what they call a foundation. And they've got $3 billion of Ethereum in that foundation now. And they use that to have people pitch them ideas on how to make their system better, and then they write them or send them Ethereum to help make their projects together. So they're totally self-financing themselves. My point is, yeah, you've got the Dogecoins and the SafeMoons and the Bitcoins, and that looks like you're just playing with magic beans and it has no value. But if you look over to this decentralized world, which I have for better part of a year now, you come away believing that we have found a way to massively disrupt the financial system. We are creating a new financial system in parallel. The big difference with this one is we've cut out the middleman. The middleman is a bank. We've greatly reduced the costs. We've increased the possibilities. And if this takes hold, it will be a huge game changer for the whole financial services business, starting with the banking and the brokerage communities, I think. And they're now just getting their head around this idea and starting to look at this as being a real possibility. And they might be too late at this point, because it is what's happening there is exciting, and what's happening there is quite innovative. And last thought I'd give you is If you go to ZipRecruiter or if you go to Glassdoor or any of these other websites that help with recruiting, if you are a really good programmer, top-notch programmer, your third choice is to go work in the financial services industry. Your second choice is to go work in Silicon Valley. And your first choice is to go work at a cryptocurrency protocol. They are hoovering up all of the best talent in the world right now to help them with these projects, because a lot of these people see the enormous potential that's going on there. They're saying no to Google. They're saying no to Apple. They're saying no to Goldman Sachs. They're saying no to JP Morgan. And they're saying yes to the Uniswaps of the world, because that's where they think the future is. Now, it might be a very volatile future. I've used the analogy. It's like me in 1997 saying to you, I think e-commerce is going to be the next big thing. And you say, great, what should I do? And I said, buy pets.com. Oh no, it went to zero. It went away. I should have waited and told you to buy Chewy, another online retailer that sells pet supplies. So the trick with this space is not, does it survive? Is I don't want to buy the pets.coms. I want to buy the Chewy's of the world. That's going to be difficult to do because there's so many projects and there's so many coming. And part of the reason you've got this massive speculation is everybody's thrown their hands in the air and said, I know what the answer is. Buy all of them. Buy every single one of them. 90% of them will go to zero, but the few that wind up winning will be tremendous winners and they'll make up for all the losses. And that's how you wind up getting all of this massive speculation that you've seen in this space.
So when you look at this, is this eventually going to replace cash? I mean, we even got governments getting involved. China is supposedly coming out with their gold-backed cryptocurrency. What about governments and central banks getting involved?
I think they're going to be too late. And I think that they're missing the point on it. Yes, it's going to replace cash. And it's going to replace cash in the following way. First of all, if it is purely decentralized and there is no central authority, and it's what technical people call peer-to-peer transactions, my computer to your computer, it can't really be regulated. There is no one you go and you hand the rules. Here's some regulations Congress just passed. It exists in the ether as a computer program that is owned by nobody. So there's no one there's no central authority running it that you can put regulations on. There's no plug you can pull to take it out. And if it is decentralized and you've cut out the middleman, you've greatly reduced the cost. So the reason I give you that background is what they're thinking is cash is going to change into many different things. There's not going to be one thing. There's going to be hundreds of things that you would call cash. Your airline miles might be referred to as an airline token, and that you will have an automatic market maker that will quote you prices for your airline token. So I could take my airline miles to the grocery store and I can buy groceries with it. The grocer could take the airline miles and he could buy shipping credits with it. The shipping credit people could take airline miles and they can buy something else with it, or they can issue their own shipping credits, or they can issue their own grocery store tokens. And there will always be a price for all of those on these automatic market makers. Now, some of that is happening, but the reason I bring this up is they're referring to this as the token economy, where we can tokenize everything. And they've talked about, I could tokenize my credit score. And I could tokenize my credit score. So if I have excess credit score, I could sell it to somebody who needs credit score. Things you would normally not think of. We have a version of that now in the economy. Airline miles, rewards programs with your credit cards, loyalty programs with your retailers. But they're so limiting because they have to run through a central authority of either a bank and or the retailer, that they're not as open to the flexibility that this environment would bring. So yes, not only will it replace cash, but there won't be one single entity called cash. There'll be many different things that will have been tokenized. All of them will have readily available value that you can interchangeably trade back and forth with each other. It's a whole complete rethink of how we do things. Some of this might not happen, but a lot of this, I think, will happen, and it will lead to a real disruption in financial services. We've done it to newspapers. We've done it to retailing. We've done it to taxis. We've done it to hotels. Next in line seems to be the financial services industry.
So given that this is unfolding, how would you play this as an investor? You know, would you just buy an ETF that holds all of them, or would you just stick with the main ones?
Yeah. So if I was to say to an investor, I think the first thing you need to do is you need to educate yourself on this. And the beautiful thing about this decentralized DeFi cryptocurrency world is it's digital. So you can open up a Coinbase account or whatever, and you can buy as little as $100 worth of this stuff. And you could transfer it onto a unregulated wallet, and you can maybe try your hand at buying something on an automatic market maker. If you mess up, you've messed up with $100. It's not going to end the world. But the act of doing that will be so enlightening to a lot of people when you start to get into this space. Now, once you're in this space, there are other what they call protocols that do have indexes that you will buy all of the top DeFi tokens as well too. They have indexes that are buying the second level of DeFi tokens. So there are versions of buying indexes within this space. In a regulated brokerage account, there's only a handful of opportunities that you have right now. Most of them are Bitcoin opportunities, you know, whether it's MicroStrategies or some of the ETFs that trade up in Canada, or maybe a Tesla if you wanted to go that far, though there's a lot of other things going on with Tesla. Or Grayscale Trust is another one as well, too. Grayscale is going to bring up possibly an Ethereum one. But if you wanted to see what's happening in this space and invest in this space, you'd have to go there directly. It is very, very early. A lot of the protocols that we're looking at now might not exist in 2 or 3 years because new protocols that don't exist now might have been created. So I would say to investors, if you're interested in investing in this space, it is so new and it's so different. Take $100 and try and learn it. And once you've learned it, I think in the process of learning it, you'll become enlightened as to its possibility. And I am using the word possibility because there is a lot of uncertainty with what we're doing. This is maybe the idea of cryptocurrencies and decentralized finance might be a home run, but what to invest in is not that easy to figure out. And that's going to be the trick that you're going to have to do. So start by learning about it.
And finally, a final question, where does gold and precious metals fit into all this scenario?
Well, in the cryptocurrency world, you've got Bitcoin, which is considered the digital equivalent of gold. And you've got another one called Litecoin, which is considered the digital equivalent of silver. These are supposed to be the store of values. These are important tools, just like gold and silver are important tools in reserve management and for central banks and for our economy today. As well, too. I am of one of those that believes that one of the reasons that gold has been languishing, as we talked about earlier, boy, it's hard to find a commodity that hasn't been soaring in the last 6 months. And one of them that hasn't been soaring is gold. And one of the reasons I think gold hasn't been soaring is I think it's got serious competition in the cryptocurrency space for the digital equivalent of it right now in Bitcoin and Litecoin being with silver. And it's take that as a sign that this is more than just useless magic beans that everybody's in this delusion that they're trading, that this is a nascent new technology that is being formulated into a new type of currency. And so in that environment, gold is not necessarily a bad place to be, but if you're thinking I got to go headlong into gold because we're going to see some inflation, and then you look at the price charts and go, man, look at what lumber is doing. And look at what copper is doing. Look at what agricultural commodities are doing. And the answer is straight up, big, all of them. Why isn't gold doing that? Well, go look at what Bitcoin's doing. It's going straight up as well, too. And so that's where I think people are expressing that view about inflation is in the digital space and not in the traditional gold and silver space.
And finally, Jim, as we close, if there's anything that you would be looking at over the next 12 months, whether it's the economy or the markets as key signals of where we go forward, what would that be?
I would probably look at politics right now. I want to see if we get to the era of bipartisanship. One of the things that I thought was most interesting about the $1.9 trillion stimulus bill that most economists got wrong and didn't even realize it is the bill came out at $1.9 trillion, and all economists said, yeah, it'll be negotiated down to $1.1 trillion. And what really happened that was unique in American history is the original bill almost verbatim passed on partisan vote without a single Republican vote. If that is the environment we're going to live in, that, you know, it's the Democrats' world because they've got the majority in the House, they've got 50 plus the vice president in the Senate, and they've got a president, Democrat president, and whatever they want, they get, and there's no need to compromise. I think that would be a problem. I'd also think it'd be a problem if it was all Republicans pushing as much on their side as well, too. I would like to see some kind of a fracturing in that and say, no, whatever we decide we have to do, we have to make sure that some people from the other side come along with us as well, too. That, I think, would be more beneficial for the economy and for the outlook for markets than just one-party autocratic rule. I don't think we're there yet, but I think this infrastructure bill is going to be key, whether or not a Joe Manchin or a Kyrsten Sinema, Manchin of West Virginia, Sinema from Arizona, are Democrats that are kind of getting a little bit shaky about the current bill, and whether or not they demand some more compromises to bring some Republicans along. That would, I think, be a good thing. But if they're pulled back into the fold and it's just rammed through party line, I think ultimately in the next year, that would be the thing I'm going to watch for, to hope to see more bipartisanship and less partisanship as a positive sign.
All right. Well, listen, Jim, if our listeners would like to follow your work and also find out more about your newsletter, how could they do so? In my opinion, one of the best written out there.
Thank you very much. Start at Twitter at Bianco Research, or go to our website, which is also named BiancoResearch.com.
All right. Well, Jim, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Stay safe and all the best.
Thank you.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth advisory team, which has been servicing clients for over 35 years, feel free to give us a call at 888, that's 888-486-3939. Also, don't forget to tell your friends and family about our podcast, Financial Sense News Hour, to stay on top of the latest developments in the market and how they impact your investments. Lastly, if you aren't already a subscriber and would like to listen to more of our premium content airing 3 days during the week through our website or through an app on your mobile device, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.